How can we increase our net worth? How can we come up with the down payment to buy our first home? How can we save money on beer? We'll have answers to these questions and more during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Do you have another personal finance question for financial planner Kevin McKinley? He'll try to answer that one, too. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet it at Joy Cardine Show. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from WPR Studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So how does it feel, Kevin, to be living in Wisconsin's newest, hippest city, the millennial magnet of Eau Claire?
I can't take all the credit for it, Joy, but I'm certainly going to take most of the credit for attracting millennials and making it the newest, hippest city in Wisconsin.
I thought so. I thought that would be the reason why. Well, let's talk about this new report from the Federal Reserve. It says Americans' net worth is at an all-time high. How much, Kevin?
$95 trillion. That's trillion with a, excuse me, with a TR, up 1.4% from the previous quarter and way up from the peak of 2007, well before the Great Recession. Back then, the peak was $65 trillion and the trough in 2009 was $56 trillion. So we're nearly double in net worth as a country of that. It works out to an average of $287,000 per American. And about $860,000 of net worth per household.
Well, that's a lot. It seems like that would be good news for everyone and for the economy. Is that the case?
You would think, but it's basically really good for some Americans and maybe not so much so for the economy. Most of that increase in net worth came from the stock market. According to the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it's just about tripled since the trough, and a little bit from housing. 10% of Americans, Joy, own about 80% of the stock market wealth. So those, of course, are the people who are getting most of these gains. And housing is just recovering to its peak, and it's not in every area. It's most of the housing net worth is increasing in several different metro areas, especially in the downtowns and other more desirable communities where people are trying to purchase homes and they're driving up the prices like crazy. Consumer spending, though, is just not accelerating nearly as much as the wealth is has accelerated. And part of that is because many of those who have benefited from the last 8 or 9 years of increase in net worth just aren't spending all of it, obviously. They've saved it. They don't have the need for it, or they're trying to save for retirement, and so they don't want to spend it today. And those who don't have the money are the ones who are more likely to spend it, but they're spending just about everything they can, and so they're kind of tapped out.
So how is this wealth spread out?
According to census data compiled by the website wallethacks.com, two common factors lead to an increase in net worth, and that's age and education. Young adults, those are adults under the age of 35, their median net worth, meaning half of them have a net worth higher than this and half of them have a net worth lower than this, is only about $6,600. That's going to make a lot of young adults feel much better that if they have $7,000 in their checking account and no other debt outstanding, they're in the top 50% for net worth of their age demographic. And in older adults, those 65 to 69, the median net worth, again, half have more, half have less, is $194,000. And those numbers are boosted up, obviously, by people who have college education or higher degree. And it's much worse off, obviously, for those people who don't.
So what do you say to those who don't, the have-nots, who feel that they're never going to become a have?
Don't give up. Older and wealthier people who are, you know, in their 50s and 60s and 70s and have a significant amount of net worth, six figures, maybe even seven figures, many of those people started out just as broke, if not more so, than you did when they were in their 20s and even their 30s. And if you're a young adult and you're concerned about, you know, you can't save very much because you can't pay off your student loans fast enough to start accumulating net worth, Just save something. Even if you save just $200 per month, that's $2,400 per year. If you can earn a 6% hypothetical annual rate of return, in 20 years, you'll have $90,000. That will put you in the upper half of net worth, probably for people in their 40s and 50s. And if you do that for 40 years, $200 per month, earning just 6% hypothetically annually, will give you $387,000 by the time you're old with us. And trust me, you will get that money and you will gladly give it up to have your youth back.
Yes. If you have a question about how you might increase your net worth, you can call 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine along with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. So here's a question from a listener named Grant, who writes, I'm 19 and I have had a Roth IRA for 3 years. Through summer jobs, I have built up close to $7,000 invested in one mutual fund, a Target 2060 fund through Vanguard. When should I look into diversifying my IRA into multiple mutual funds? Thanks for the show. Well, thanks for the question, Grant. What do you say, Kevin?
Yeah, Grant, first of all, congratulations. That's fantastic. As we just mentioned from the previous figures, if you can accumulate $7,000 by the time you're just 19, that's wonderful. And I would guess that that's in the top 5% of 19-year-olds in the country for retirement savings. And if Grant can continue to do that, just the $7,000 alone, let's say Grant never saves anything else for retirement whatsoever. Again, if he earns that hypothetical 6% per year, by the time he's 65, he'll have $105,000, which is great. But if he can continue to save $5,000 per year from the age of 19 to 65, and he starts with the $7,000 at 6% hypothetically, he would have $1.3 million at age 65.
So did Grant pick the right investment vehicle to get him started?
Actually, I think it's a great one to start with. Those are called target date funds, and as we've mentioned before, those are usually a combination of stock mutual funds, bond mutual funds, and there might be some money market or cash accounts in there as well. And the 2060 refers to the year in which you think you might start needing that money, and so it will be more aggressive now and gradually become more conservative as the year 2060 draws closer. Now, it doesn't mean that it can't drop, especially now when it's a more aggressive fund, or even towards the end of the period, but it does mean that it's more likely to drop less when you're more likely to need the money near your goal date.
So even though he's using one fund, he's actually using several?
Yes. According to the Vanguard site, if you just put $7,000 into the Vanguard Target Date 2060 fund, you have, first of all, four different mutual funds. And within those four different mutual funds, you have about 9,800 different stocks and about 12,700 different bonds scattered all over the world. So you have a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of money in every single one of those 20-some thousand different securities. And you can diversify more if you want for it, especially if you accumulate more money. But what I would prefer, especially for someone who's starting out, is diversify by putting your growth money into something that is more aggressive, that's going to have more potential risk and reward over the long term because you're less likely to need it. But then take your savings, your emergency money, and keep that very safe. And this would be accumulating 3 to 6 months worth of expenses and try to keep it in the money market accounts. Maybe Series I savings bonds are a good place to go, or certificates of deposit that have a relatively small penalty for early withdrawal. Those investments won't go up very much. You might make maybe 1 or 2% in a year for the time being, but they're not going to go down. And so that'll balance out your portfolio. So if the stock market does really well over the next 30 years, 40 years, you'll make a ton of money in your long-term money. But if you have a bad year, both personally and investment-wise, that cash will be great to have, and it'll be good to not see it going down at all.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a personal finance question for him, we have a line for you at 1-800-642-1234. In fact, call that number. Even if you don't have a personal finance question, I want to see if the phones are working. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email your question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can post your question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Coming up a little bit later during this edition of On Your Money, we'll be getting some advice on coming up with the down payment for a first home, and we will find out how we can save money on beer, plus answers to your personal finance questions on Your Money here on the Ideas Network. We will get some advice on coming up with the down payment for a first home in just a few minutes here during On Your Money, but we are welcoming your questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Until then, and Libby in West Salem is with us. Hi, Libby.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is your question for Kevin?
Is that
your question? Yes. my question is, I am self-employed. I work at an Army base as a barber, and I deal mainly in cash every day, and then I get like a small percentage check at the end of the month for anything that's left over that wasn't paid to my boss for my rental. And my husband and I are having kind of a difficult time trying to save the small amounts of cash that are kind of coming in every day so that we can make sure our bills are paid, and we're kind of worried about taxes at the end of the year. And I'm just wondering, you know, kind of what percentage of what I'm making that I should put, like, in a savings account to make sure I have enough to cover taxes, and if you have any advice on just paying bills when you get, you know, a little bit of money every day, you know, what I should kind of put away for that as well.
That is tricky to do, because I bet every time, Libby, that a dollar comes in, you already know a place that dollar needs to go, right?
And I do, but then at the same time, it's like, you know, if I have like $100, let's say at the end of the day, it's, you know, should we buy groceries and get gas and whatnot. And it seems to kind of dwindle a lot faster than I have time to stop and put it in the bank.
Sure. Do you know, Libby, have you ever sat down and said, here is actually where all that money is going? It's going towards food and gas, et cetera, but here are the dollar amounts?
Not really. We try to take a look at, you know, what it is that we need to pay. And my husband works as well, so when he gets his check or when I get my commission check at the end of the month, you know, we kind of try and pay our bills off of that. But it's the everyday, I feel like I'm making a lot more than we're actually, seeing, because we spend it a little quicker because it's cash in our hand and it's,
right.
Let's get gas and let's go do this or that, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, the good news, first of all, Libby, is by just using cash, there is an advantage to doing so versus plastic, because if you have $20 in your pocket and you either don't have a piece of plastic like a debit or a credit card, or you're just refusing to use it, well, guess what? $20 is all you can spend on anything. And so there is something to be said for using cash for spending. But I'd rather have you start looking at specifically where that money is going. And so I'd actually rather have you start using plastic and putting all the cash in the bank. Stop spending the cash. because it's harder to track where that's going unless you're willing to save all of your receipts and then add them up. And it sounds like you're very busy, and it's difficult for a lot of people to do. So instead, put all the cash in the bank, or put it in a safe, or put it in a piggy bank, someplace you can't get at it, and then start using your plastic and see if your bank or credit union has a program where they will show you, in a general sense, where your money has gone in the given month. And if they don't, you can use something like mint.com, M-I-N-T.com. That ties into your banking system, and it's a relatively reputable service. It's free. It's kind of advertising supported. But they'll do a great job of saying, every time you use your plastic, here's where it went, and here were the dollar amounts. And then at the end of the month, here were the total portions of all of your spending and where it went. And the reason that's valuable is so not only that you can track it, but you can look to say, gosh, we spent $300 eating out this month. Let's try to knock that back down to $200. Or is there a way that that we can spend a little bit less on groceries? Are we buying smart when we're shopping for groceries? And then that shows you where you can cut back if that's possible. And then the second thing I would do is by putting that cash into a bank account or a checking account instead and depositing it, you can then have maybe a portion of that set out by yourself so it automatically goes into a different account that you can use to maybe pay for taxes at the end of the quarter or payroll taxes on an ongoing basis, or if you owe income taxes on April 15th of next year. And if you don't owe any income taxes, what you can do then is you have the opportunity to say, gosh, we have this extra money. Let's put this in a Roth IRA. Or if we need a tax deduction, let's put it in a regular IRA so that we can save our taxes a little bit and save for retirement for this. So I'd actually stop using the cash, start using plastic, and then track your spending a little better and see if there's any place you can cut back.
That's a great idea. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck, Libby.
Thank you, Libby. Let's go next to Susan in Oconomowoc. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Kevin, you're wonderful. I listen to you. I've got all my financial advice, and it comes from you, and I'm known around the house as the financial expert. So thank you.
I will take all the praise and absolutely none of the liability. So okay. Thank you, Susan.
Here's the situation, and maybe I'm confused. My daughter has got kind of an entry-level job with the government, and she can get – she's maxing out her retirement. But the question is, she can either put it in a regular retirement account or a Roth retirement account. And I was wondering, if she puts it in a Roth retirement account, can she still do an IRA, and how much can she have? And should she use the Roth retirement or the regular retirement?
Right. Then it's a very good question, Susan. It's it really boils down to, at what tax rate will you defer this money, or in this case your daughter, will she defer the money versus the tax at which she'll pull it out? And if she's making more than, is she married or
no,
single?
No, she's single.
Okay. If she's making more than $50,000 gross, there's a good chance that part of that income is going to be taxed at the 25% federal income tax bracket. And most people who retire, especially middle class people, retire and spend their money that puts them in a tax bracket that's lower than the 25% federal bracket. It's usually the 15% federal tax bracket. Now, that can change, but if you believe that things are going to be pretty much the same for the next 30 years for taxes, and I think they will be, there'll be lots of tweaks, but you can't get blood from a stone, as they say, and so trying to say that taxes are going to go up a lot on middle class income people, that's just not going to be the case, because they just don't have a lot of money left over to pay in income taxes. So what I would say is, she's better off deferring money into a 401k and then using the Roth IRA for any extra savings, because the Roth IRA doesn't give her a tax break, but she can pull the contributions back out whenever she wants with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. So I'd rather have her flip the switch rather than doing the Roth 401k and then an IRA. I'd rather have her do the 401k with the pre-tax contributions to it, and then any money that's left over but maybe not quite able to be earmarked for retirement that might be 30 or 40 years down the road, I'd rather have her put that in the Roth IRA and maybe invest it a little bit more conservatively than she does with the 401k as well.
Okay, is there a limit to how much if you're doing the Roth both ways, is there a limit there?
There is. It's usually going to work. She's under 50, right?
Yeah.
Okay. It's $18,000 for the Roth 401k, and then $5,500 for the Roth IRA, or her earnings, whichever are okay. Less for it. We're going to talk about this. It was just a study released that showed a way that the Roth 401k actually does – outperform the regular 401k for contributions, but it's not in the way that one might expect. It has to do with human behavior, but we're going to talk about that in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Susan. Stay tuned. Tom in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Joyce. Kevin, I just came into some money. I'm 45 years old. I'm broke. I haven't planned for retirement. I don't have a 401 or anything, so I'm kind of crunch time. I just got a check for $50,000 even. It's all taxes are paid on it, and I got probably $10,000 in my savings account. And I want to know what to do with this money. The best thing to do with this money at this time.
Well, first of all, Tom, you're not broke. As we just established in an earlier segment in the show, you're rapidly moving up in the ranks of net worth for Americans. And to be fair to you and everybody else out there, a lot of times this is how people become financially independent: is somebody who cared about them or didn't have anybody else they cared more about passes away and says, "Well, I don't know what else to do with this money, so here, you can have it." And that happens more often than one might imagine. It's not a good way to plan for financial security. And 45 is incredibly young, Tom, when it comes to setting money aside, saving for retirement. And then finally, one of the big advantages, the reason, you know, people are thin is because they don't have access to food. One of the keys to becoming financially independent is not to spend very much money and not develop a lifestyle that costs a lot. And by being broke, as you say, you probably don't spend a whole lot of money every single month, right?
Yeah, I have no debt at all.
Yeah. Do you own a home or do you rent?
I pay rent. It's really a cheap place. I live in I'm a single guy, so I have no kids. So okay. I live in like a little apartment. It's like less than $500 a month.
It's perfect. Okay, and are you working right now?
Yep, I work for the state, and I make probably $40,000.
Oh no, you're doing great. You're doing great. Is part of the state? Are you a participant in the state retirement plan?
I just got that job. I just changing jobs, so it's a brand new job with the state.
Okay, great. Well, so you're going to have some benefits there. You've also probably been working for most of your adult life, I would guess.
That's right.
Okay, then you're going to have Social Security as well, and I bet, Tom, like a lot of people, when you finally do collect Social Security in your 60s, you're going to receive more from Social Security than you actually made working in several years of your life, especially when you were younger. So that's another component for this. So here's what I would do.
It says like I've contributed over $100,000 or something right. So far to Social Security. So yeah,
that's fantastic. So you're going to have several different sources of income in retirement. The question is what to do with this money between now and then. And the first thing you want to do is continue what you're doing. Remember when you said you had the $10,000 in savings?
Yeah.
Keep that there and just leave it alone. Don't touch it. That's your emergency money, your rainy day fund, your safety net. If something goes wrong, based on your lifestyle, if you should lose this job, that $10,000 would probably keep you going for quite a while until you found another job, right?
Yep.
All right. Then the $50,000, what I'd like to see you do with that is maybe split half of it into a longer-term certificate of deposit, like a five-year one that might pay you about 2%. And it usually has very little penalty for early withdrawal. And then take the rest of it and put it slowly but surely into one of two or three accounts. And that would either be a Roth IRA if you're going to be in a low tax bracket, which I think you are, or you can use the deferred comp plan through the state, or a regular IRA. And the regular IRA gives you a tax break now, but it will be taxable when you pull it out in retirement. And you can go to your local bank or credit union. You can go to a local financial services firm. You can call Schwab, Fidelity, Vanguard. All these kinds of places will help you set those accounts up. And in some cases, they might even give you some guidance as to which one of the accounts is best for you if you are going to open up a Roth IRA or an IRA.
Good luck to you, Tom. Thanks very much for the call. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And And it's time for Smart Assets. We have been covering tips for first-time home buyers over the past several weeks. This week, we are going to discuss how to overcome the biggest barrier to buying a first home. And what is the biggest barrier, Kevin?
That is the down payment. Usually it's about 20% of the purchase price of the home. And in America right now, the median home price is right around $200,000. And if you need to come up with 20% of $200,000, that's $40,000. And that's very tough for young adults who are also paying rent, making student loan payments, paying for food, groceries, etc., to come up with that. So we're going to talk to you how you can maybe get around that or accelerate the process a little bit.
Yeah, so where should a first-time home buyer start?
One thing I'd like to see, and I hear this sometimes from young adults, and by the way, many of the young adults I talk with about their finances, I'm really impressed with them. We're going to talk more about this over the coming weeks and months, but many of them are doing the right thing with their money, and they're doing the best thing they possibly can given the conditions that they graduated into or even when they came out of high school with. But what a lot of them don't realize is that their parents did not leave high school or leave college and move into a 5,000-square-foot home, three-car garage in the suburbs. They usually started out in a one- or two-room apartment, even together, or they lived with two or three other people. And so if you're really committed to buying a home, you might want to make that small sacrifice now to live in a much smaller apartment that's cheaper, live with some roommates, even live with your parents. And one of the nice things about living with your parents is the more miserable that it is for all of you, the more motivation that you'll have to save, not take any vacations, stop saving for retirement. That's something that I think is okay if you say, I really need to save up for a home. It's okay to temporarily stop saving for retirement so you can build up the cash for the down payment. And many people who you look at when they're 50 or 60, when they were 20 or 30, they had part-time jobs along with a full-time job so that they could earn extra money to do things like buy a house.
Speaking of motivation, if the kids are living with the parents, the moms and dads might be more motivated to help out the kids, right?
Yeah, help them out and help them get out, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's a very common source of money for the down payment. The money needs to be in the kids' hands for a while before applying for the loan. Lenders call this, that they want the money to be in place in the account so it looks like it's actually the kids' money and they didn't blow through with it. They get a little concerned if they say, wait, you had $12 in your checking account, now all of a sudden you have $40,000. You didn't accumulate that on your own. Where did it come from? And then they may want the person, whoever gave it to you, to write a letter saying, this is a gift. It's not a loan. I do not expect to be paid back for it. And only will they then accept that money as a source for down payment. Parents and grandparents and anybody else can give kids or grandkids $14,000 per year with no gift taxes and no gift tax form. If they give more than that $14,000 per person per year, then they still won't owe any gift taxes on it, but they may have to file a gift tax return. And kids, once you get that money in your hands, keep it safe. You really can't invest that and take a lot of risk with it to try to get a greater return. Put it in a short-term CD or something you can get immediate access to so it's there when you're ready to purchase the house.
Kevin, what do you think about tapping retirement accounts to get the down payment?
I don't know if that's the best idea, but it's not the worst idea, especially if you commit to saving more for retirement to replace that money. And there are several different ways to do so. You may be able to get a loan against your 401k at work, but then keep in mind, part of your paycheck is going to go towards paying off that loan. You can pull money out of your IRA for a down payment for the first-time home purchase. You will pay taxes on the money that you pull out, but you will not pay the 10% penalty. And then, as we mentioned earlier, if you've accumulated money in a Roth IRA and you need it for a home or whatever, you can always pull the contributions out of that Roth IRA with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And the good people at the IRS will let you designate the withdrawals as contributions until you've used all those up. So if you put $5,000 aside for 5 years, you can now pull $25,000 out of your Roth IRA for any reason with no taxes and no penalties whatsoever.
So are there any programs that borrowers can qualify for a mortgage that might have a lower down payment?
There are several. FHA loans can allow you to get into a home for a down payment as low as 3.5% of the purchase price. It doesn't qualify for everybody and every property, and you are going to have to pay some fees on top of that. The USDA has a program that can be as low as 0% down on certain rural and suburban homes. If you get these low-down payment programs, though, your payment is going to be higher because not only are you going to have a larger mortgage payment, but you probably will have to pay what's known as private mortgage insurance, and again, you may have to pay some fees on top of it as well. So as we mentioned a couple weeks ago, if you are thinking about buying a home, or especially if you're buying your first home, don't go to the open houses. Don't call a realtor. Go to the lender first and say, here's who we are. Here's what we want to do. Tell us what we need to do between now and that time so that we can qualify for the loan, and what kind of loan might we qualify for.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a personal finance question for Kevin. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. Emily in Sauk City is with us. Hi, Emily.
Hello. I am 30 years old and have mostly worked within the home sphere as an adult. Being a stay-at-home parent, I have a two-year-old, and my father passed away this last year, leaving a big chunk of his 401k to my two-year-old. What do I do? Should I leave it in there? Should I put it someplace else? What's the best way to handle that so that I can provide the best opportunity for my kiddo?
Yeah, Emily, sorry about the loss of your father. He sounds like he was a really forward-thinking, benevolent guy to not only leave the money in the 401k, but to leave it to his grandchild. Did you have to do anything with that, or is it still sitting in the same 401k?
It's still sitting in the same 401k.
Okay, have you contacted the administrator of that to say, how do we get this all retitled, or what's happened with that?
Yep, it's all retitled as of right now, as far as I can tell, in my child's name. I just don't know if that's the best place for it to be, or if, as the guardian, I should be putting it into something that I don't know. I don't know what the options are.
Okay, well, I would, how much is it, Emily?
About
$70? $70,000. Okay, that's a great amount of money. And this actually, as you're probably aware, it's a lot of money today. It can really set up a two-year-old for life, not in terms of spending all of it, but in terms of investing it wisely. So I'm glad you're asking about it. You're going to have some required minimum distributions from that you should actually move this into what's known as an inherited IRA, and it may be based on the two-year-old's life expectancy. So some of that you're going to have to take out every single year, and it's going to be taxed. It's going to be taxed generally at a very low rate, and you're not going to have to take very much out of it. Has anybody talked to you about that yet?
Nope.
Okay. I would contact the people who are the custodians of the account. There must be some financial services firm who has this, and say, do I have to take anything out of this the way that it's set up? If so, how much? And who's going to make that calculation? Is it me who's required to do it? And by me, I mean you. And if so, who's going to do that every single year? And how do we figure this out? And here's what I would do with that is I would leave the money in the retirement account as long as you can, because the tax deferral is great. But I would pull it out slowly and then put the required minimum distributions, if there are any, into a 529 account, a college savings account for your child. And that's a neat way to save money for college, to have that build up. And then that'll be ready to be used in 16 years, hopefully, when your child is off to some form of higher education. But then at the same time, it should maintain a larger balance, tax-deferred in the retirement account, so that the money will not only be there in the future for these same required minimum distributions, but also could also serve as your child's retirement account at some day in the future as well. And again, I'll be blown away if you just take the required minimum distributions out, and if you invest it relatively wisely, that could be literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, by the time your grandchild turns 65 or your child turns 65.
Awesome
is right. Thank you very much, Emily, for the call. When we come back, Kevin will have some advice on saving money on a favorite Wisconsin beverage during the summer, beer. We'll talk about saving money on buying beer and more answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Curtin with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
I don't have enough to pay my rent. I ain't gonna worry though. I got time for one more round and a six-pack to go.
I'm Joy Curtin with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network, and we have been discussing some ways that you can economically quench your thirst this summer. And as the heat rises, we figure it's a good reason as any to talk about beer. Kevin, we can save some money on beer this summer?
Sure. It's not the thing you want to cut back on expense completely. You might find yourself carrying around the 40-ounce malt liquor bottle. That's probably the most economical way to drink beer. And if that's your favorite beer, more power to you. If you're going to walk about in the streets, put it in a paper bag. It's a little classier that way. Half of alcohol consumed in the United States, Joy, is beer. And according to the Gallup poll, it is the number one drink of choice of Americans when they are drinking alcohol. 43% say that. It is the number one drink for 54% of men and 23% of women. The United States only ranks about 14th, though, in per capita consumption of beer. Czechoslovakia is not only number one, but has been number one, I think, for 23 years in a row. Wisconsin, believe it or not, is not the number one state for beer consumption per capita. It's sixth in the country. The cost per 12-ounce serving of beer is usually about a dollar. Now, we've been talking about other ways to quench your thirst, and beer is about four times more expensive than the bottled water, milk, and soda that we've discussed in the past. So there's a good reason to analyze what you're spending on your beer and ways you can save.
Yeah, I'm shocked by those figures, really. That we're, but where do we start?
If you're drinking for quantity, definitely stock up on sales and at the big box stores, the Costco's, the Sam Clubs, etc. When these places have sales, they do loss leaders, and you can definitely get a very good deal on the name brand mass marketed beer. Get the cost per serving down to about 75 cents for 12 ounces, but definitely check the sell by date, because the minute beer is bottled, it starts to go bad, and you can usually store it for about 4 to 6 months without it going bad if it's warm, you know, just in the basement or the garage. But 8 to 12 months if it's refrigerated. So try to get it in a dark place if you can, and if you can keep it cold, do so.
What if your beer drinking goal is quality over quantity?
Quality over quantity. Then you might want to look at the craft beers, the micro brews. You are going to spend more on serving per serving than you would the mass marketed beers. You're going to get a little bit more alcohol generally in those craft beers, but the growth in those has been huge. Back in 1990, there were 250 licenses for breweries in the United States, and right now there are about 7,200. And growth of craft beers had soared just up about until last year. It kind of leveled out a little bit with about a 1.3% increase in the volume. It still only is about 9% of the U.S. market for beer by volume, but 14% by dollars. So you're generally going to spend more on craft beer than you will on the mass marketed ones, but you're probably hopefully going to drink a little less. So consider the serving size when you're buying it, and consider how fast you have to drink it. The big growlers, if you will, that you can fill up at some of these smaller breweries, you usually have to drink those pretty quickly, either yourself or with someone else. Sign up for info from the brewery or from the liquor store via Facebook or their Twitter page, or maybe they have an email newsletter that will alert you to sales and specials that you otherwise would miss out on. And then again, drink it quickly, because craft beer is actually more, it's more interesting, it's going to be more varied, but it's also might be a little bit more likely to go off faster, so that's when you want to drink it quickly. There's a really great website called brewtrail.com where you can go on, and of the 217 places that are licensed right now to have some kind of brewery facility, you can actually not only check each one around the area, see what's in a specific area, but maybe plan a trip by visiting different breweries, and it'll tell you which ones offer food, what their hours are, etc., and what kind of beers they're brewing. Brewtrail.com will have that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
So what about some advice for the serious beer drinker?
So if you have one favorite brand that you really enjoy, whether it's a mass marketed one or a craft beer, the more expensive it is, the better off it is to buy a quarter barrel or even a half barrel of it and put it in with a keg and a tap and a refrigerator. It's very expensive initially to set up. You can spend about $500 on a fridge plus another few hundred dollars on the equipment to do so. But it's much more cost effective because you're looking at maybe about probably 20 to 30 cents per 12-ounce serving versus a dollar or more per serving if you buy it in the bottle. Now, a lot of people think if they buy beer and tap it themselves, it's almost an indefinite shelf life. But still, keg beer can go bad, and it can go bad anywhere from 1 to 6 months, depending on how it's stored and how warm it is around the keg. So if you are going to go do that, you actually have to drink it more quickly than you would if it were just bottled beer set aside. An economical way to get around the kegerators, if you will, is to just see if you can find, if you have a second refrigerator, drill a hole in the side of it and just put a tap on it and run the hose through back in through the refrigerator for it. It's a good use of an old refrigerator if you have one out in the garage. And, of course, keg beer is more environmentally friendly because according to kegerator.com, which is a maker, they're obviously biased by this, but they are a maker of refrigerators designed specifically for kegs. It has 68% lower environmental waste than bottled beer because you don't have to transport all the cans, bottles, whatever, from one place to another, and you don't have all the wrapping and the disposal issues as well.
So does that keg setup work well for you, Kevin?
Tell you what, there is a house at 102 South Randall Street in Madison, Wisconsin, which in the mid-80s, we had an experiment that it worked very well for 3 years, and then we would go back to this place during Badgers games or whatever just to just to annoy the younger people who were living there. And that fridge was still there at least 10 or 15 years after we moved out. So, yes, it's a very economical way for college kids to have beer.
Ryan on Facebook chimed in on the beer topic. He says, Boxer beer by the Minhas Brewery in Monroe is the best value, in my opinion. It comes in a 36-pack for about $13.50, and it actually tastes good. That sounds really cheap.
That could be their new slogan.
Right.
Minhas Brewery, it actually tastes good.
Well, you can post your favorite beer deal on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you'd like to share it, but you can also call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a personal finance question for financial planner Kevin McKinley. Back to the phones we go, and Ellie in Madison is with us now. Hi, Ellie.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks so much for taking my phone call. So I've been wanting to ask you a question. I was with a previous employer for many years, and I've left the company, but I had a 401k with them, and it's been there for, maybe 10 years with the bank that it was administered by. And I'm with a current employer now for almost 4 years, and my 401k is still with that bank. And I was wondering if I should withdraw it and transfer it to an IRA or even roll it over into my current 401k. But the one that I have at my previous employer, I paid very low admin fees, maybe nothing at all, because when I was with them, they took care of it all. So I'm just wondering, what are the consequences if I should put it into my current 401k or even put into an IRA where I'll have more control over it, but there's quite a large amount of money in it. So I'm just afraid of, you know, if I move it, what do I pay? Are there going to be fees associated with that, or should I just leave it alone and let it go with the interest?
Ellie, we really appreciate you asking this question because a lot of people have the same one, and it's actually a tricky situation. There's more nuance to it than most people would guess. First of all, yes, you can roll it over to your new 401k if the current employer allows that. You can also roll it to an IRA, and if you do it properly, and most times custodians will help you do this so you don't run into problems, but if you do it properly, there's no taxes on it. There might be some fees, very small ones, like maybe to close the account at the old place. They might charge you $50, or they might charge you a $50 or $100 fee to transfer it. So that's it's a lot of money if it's lying on the floor. It's a relatively small portion of the account. But here's why I would say you might not want to roll it over. Ellie, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 47.
Okay. If you have a 401k that is held at a previous employer, meaning you don't work there anymore, you've separated from service, as they say.
Yeah.
Once you reach 55, you can pull that money out of the 401k and live off of it. And you will pay taxes on it, but you will not pay the 10% penalty that you otherwise usually pay when you tap pre-tax retirement accounts before the age of 59 and a half. And a lot of people don't know this. And so if you say, well, I don't think that's going to be a problem, I'm independently wealthy, I'll definitely won't need any money for retirement, then you might want to roll it over into an IRA, which would increase your opportunities for investing. You can pick from a much wider variety of choices. Or you can roll it into the current 401k, and that makes it easier to manage. But if you just like the mental safety or maybe the enjoyment of knowing that if you run into a financial bind when you're 55 or over and you've left that account where it is, you can then pull it out and you only pay taxes on it. Now, you're going to pay taxes on it anyway. And by definition, if you need that money, Allie, you're probably not going to be working. You're probably not going to have a high income. And therefore, the tax rate on that withdrawal will be little or nothing. And so if you can stand keeping it there, and the other thing that I like that you said that it had very low expenses, that's another reason to keep it there. So if you can kind of maintain the statements, the previous employer lets you keep it there. Mm-hmm. I would keep it there at least until you get to the point where you're 59 and a half and you say, all right, now that special window of opportunity is not going to apply to me anymore. Now I can do whatever I want with it.
So now you mentioned that the 10% penalty won't be there once I'm 55. So if I roll it, say, into my current 401k and I need to withdraw it when I'm 55 or over, then I would still have to pay the 10% penalty, correct?
It's I believe it's possible to avoid that, but it's trickier because it's now been commingled with the other funds, and so it's tougher to do that. I'd rather have you keep it there, so it's just easier to get at it in a hurry without a lot of work to it. And so that way, if you just keep it in the old account, you don't have to make any contributions to it. You can change it anytime you want within those funds, but in the meantime, it's there for if you'll need it.
Good luck, Ellie. D. Bob in Baraboo is with us. Hi, D. Bob.
Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
Okie dokie. I'm a loyal listener, and you two are just a great pair to listen to.
Thank you, D. Bob.
Thank you, D. Bob. I appreciate that. If you check with our respective spouses, you might get some argument with that. But
yes, Joy always asks the right question, and Kevin... You answer those questions.
Isn't it amazing how that works?
We're starting to get the hang of it, D-Bob, after 650 shows.
You know, D-Bob, we're almost out of time,
yes,
unfortunately. Do you have a quick one?
Yes. My question deals with spiders and their electronic funds, I believe. I've seen them advertised, but I'm not sure exactly what they are. Do you need a broker? And I would like to invest about $10,000.
Yeah. D-Bob, I'm going to jump in because we have only a minute, Kevin.
Yeah, spiders are kind of an exchange-traded fund. It's a mutual fund that trades like a stock during the day. And you can invest this much. You can go to a discount broker, Schwab, Fidelity, TD Ameritrade, E-Trade. A lot of these different places do those. They'll help you set it up. And you can usually buy and sell them for a relatively low cost. It might be $25 to $50 at the most per transaction. So, yeah, I think they're fine. Understand you have to analyze the underlying securities in the spider or the exchange-traded fund to know if it's the right investment for you.
Thanks, D-Bob. What's the website of the week, Kevin?
If you want to check your wealth or income against the rest of the world, go to globalrichlist.com. Enter it in, and I guarantee you will be pleasantly surprised at the results. Globalrichlist.com, and we'll have that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. On Your Money is heard live Tuesday mornings at 8 here on the Ideas Network and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.